says the Portland-based company is riding the wave of change that has been getting even more attention since President Bush declared in his State of the Union address the nation is addicted to foreign oil. One of his best customers is Willamette Valley Vineyards founder and president Jim Bernot, who has switched most of his vineyard equipment and delivery fleet to biodiesel. The delivery vans have been running on gasoline-based engines that ate into his profits, he said. In Oregon, former Governor John Kitzhaber has launched a bipartisan effort with Republican Senator Ben Westlin to make sure Oregon isn't left behind in the pursuit of biofuels and other alternative energy sources. Kitzhaber and Westlin have teamed up to support an alternative energy initiative called Oregon Apollo. They hope to place on the November ballot after the 2005 legislature got mired in partisan wrangling over a similar energy bill that died in the session. Westlin and other biofuel advocates were on the losing side of a battle offering tax incentives for producing alternative fuels, such as ethanol, to partly replace gasoline or vegetable oil that can power diesel engines. The New Oregon Initiative is a state version of a national effort called the Apollo Alliance, which took its name from the 1960s Apollo moon landing project launched by President John F. Kennedy. The alliance wants to promote a sense of urgency about converting to biofuels that will motivate the nation, like the race to put a man on the moon nearly 40 years ago.
Becky, do you think maybe termite guts could be the key to kicking the nation's oil addiction? Yes, termite guts and other bugs genetically engineered to spew enzymes that turn waste into fuel. Scientists in several companies are working with microbes to convert wood, corn stalks, and other plant waste into sugars that are easily brewed into ethanol that can then be used to power cars. At the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, Jared Ledbetter is mining the guts of termites for possible tools to turn wood chips into ethanol. Ledbetter says there's some 200 bugs that live in termite bellies that help the household pest convert wood to energy. Despite the challenges, Bush's endorsement and advancements in the field have re-energized alternative energy research.
A new study says tiny creatures known as zooplankton may be the key to fattening up juvenile salmon enough to survive in the ocean. A species of zooplankton called copepods that thrive in cold water in the Northeast Pacific Ocean have a high level of lipids or fats, possibly boosting the food chain and allowing salmon to grow fast enough to survive their first year at sea. The copepods store high amounts of fats in order to hibernate during the winter, much like bears, according to Oregon State University researchers. The copepods, in turn, are eaten by juvenile anchovies, herrings, smelt, and krill, boosting the fat content of those species and making them highly nutritious for young coho and chinook salmon, as well as other predators. For years, scientists and fishing industry have known that good ocean conditions are critical to salmon survival and are linked with strong upwelling that brings nutrient-rich, deeper waters to the surface. Researchers say the cold water copepods are most abundant during La Nina years when the ocean cools slightly. The study will be presented at the American Geophysical Union's Ocean Sciences meeting February 20th through 24th in Honolulu. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Placentas from as many as 700 women from hospitals throughout Oregon, California, and Washington were sent to Cascadia Placenta Registry from 1996 to 2003. And many of the women whose placentas were sent to Cascadia were unaware of the practice. Several Oregon hospitals and their parent corporations helped finance Cascadia and sent placental materials there. The Oregonian reports that those included Providence Health System, Legacy Health System, Adventist Health, Peace Health, Kaiser Permanente Northwest, and Good Shepherd Health Care System.
The Armed Forces Recruiting Center on Northeast Broadway was picketed this past Saturday. KBOO's Andy Seaton was there and has this story.
Several organizations picketed the Military Recruiting Center in Northeast Portland over the weekend. The No War Drum Corps, Code Pink, War Resisters League, and others were out in force making noise and handing out literature. They were protesting the military's deceptive recruiting practices.
They're making false promises. They're taking advantage of kids who, you know, come from low-income families or don't have a lot of options after high school, and they're encouraging them to sign up for the military and making all kinds of promises when they know damn well that, you know, they're probably just going to wind up in Iraq.
The War Resisters League also goes into schools to get their message directly to students being targeted by the military.
It's really up to the teachers if they're willing to have us in. you know, we don't really ask the principals because they're too concerned about public opinion and everything. But if an individual teacher can say it's part of their curriculum and so forth, then we can get in and do that. The War Resisters League also sponsors a project where we stand out in front of the high schools and pass out these little bookmark-shaped flyers, you know, just to give students some contact information and a little blurb on, you know, what's wrong with the military recruiting program, that kind of thing. We also sometimes put ads in student newspapers, too. We try to, you know, do a smattering of things to try to get the word out. You know, we're not here to tell students what to do, but we want them to know what their options are and want to encourage them to think critically about these issues.
The protesters were also getting out the word on the upcoming third anniversary of the war in Iraq.
We're trying to start the publicity for the March 19th massive peace rally and march to bring the troops home now and end the occupation of Iraq and the Palestinian territories and, you know, other issues that are definitely very related to that, such as the human rights issues and civil liberty issues as well.
The March 19th march will start in Waterfront Park at 1:30 p.m. The recruiting station is also picketed every second Saturday of the month from 11 till 1. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
The recent furor over an Oregon State University logging study highlights the enormous role federal funding plays in university research and the growing contribution federal dollars make to the campus's bottom line. Federal research dollars awarded to Oregon State, the University of Oregon, and Oregon Health Science University, for example, in 2004 to 2005, exceeded what each campus received from the state general fund. And at OSU, federal funding also trumped what the university got from tuition and fees. But the university's success in attracting the highly competitive grants underscores a difficult tension. That's the need to be accountable for publicly funded research while keeping it free from outside influence and even interference. In the case of the logging study, the Federal Bureau of Land Management restored a grant that it had yanked from OSU's Colleges of Forestry, but not before OSU faculty and Washington State congressmen spoke out against what they saw as political meddling in science. The controversy comes as the Bush administration is being criticized for quashing science that doesn't match its policies in such areas as stem cell research, pollution, and global warming. Last month, NASA's top climate scientist complained that the space agency's public affairs office was trying to silence his statements about the need for prompt reductions in greenhouse gases linked to global warming. This position is at odds with the Bush administration's policy of using voluntary measures to slow emissions growth.
The Village Council meeting of Dignity Village operates with a parliamentary efficiency more suited to C-SPAN. They vote on evictions, debate protocols, and agree to spend $22 for internet service. The discussion provides a glimpse into the five-year-old Northeast Portland social experiment known as Dignity Village, which this week is nearing its first written contract with the city. But as the sides continue final negotiations, the contract raises a simple question about the homeless camp's mission. Is Dignity Village transitional housing intended to help the poor get back on their feet, or is it permanent shelter for those who don't plan to move? The contract doesn't provide much of an answer. It contains no provisions to help residents find permanent housing, even though that's a primary goal of the agreement, and it sets no benchmarks to measure achievement. More than half of Dignity Village's residents have lived there for 2 years or more. Local advocates for the homeless say they have little or no contact with the village. And as far as Dignity Village residents are concerned, those who move in can stay as long as they want. Residents of hospices in the West Hills do not stay up late wondering where they will live next, and neither do the citizens of Dignity Village.
Vice President Dick Cheney accidentally shot a lawyer this weekend while on a hunting trip. 78-year-old Harry Whittington is recovering in stable condition today after Cheney shot him during a weekend quail hunting adventure. Whittington's an Austin attorney. He was flown to the hospital after the shooting late Saturday afternoon at the Armstrong Ranch. The vice president visited Whittington and his wife before returning to Washington yesterday. Whittington sent word through a hospital official that he would have no comment on the incident out of respect for Cheney. Catherine Armstrong is the ranch's owner. She said the incident occurred after Cheney, Whittington, and another hunter got out of a car to shoot at a covey of quail. She said Whittington went to retrieve a bird he shot. Cheney and the third hunter, whom she wouldn't identify, walked to another spot, discovered a second covey of quail. Armstrong, who was in the car, said Whittington came up from behind the vice president and the other hunter and didn't signal them or indicate to them or announce himself. Armstrong said the shot knocked him silly, but he was fine. He was talking. His eyes were open. It didn't get in his eyes or anything like that.
The CIA official in charge of intelligence on Middle East until last year has accused the Bush administration of ignoring assessments that sanctions and weapon inspections were the best way to deal with Saddam Hussein, and that an invasion would have a messy aftermath. In an article in the next edition of the bimonthly journal, Foreign Affairs, Paul Pillar has become the highest-ranking CIA official from the pre-war period to accuse the White House of manipulating the intelligence on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. The allegations contradict the findings of two official inquiries into the intelligence debacle. They have largely blamed the CIA and absolved the administration. They also emerged on the day it was reported that Louis Libby, a former aide to Vice President Dick Cheney, had told a grand jury that he had been ordered by his superiors to leak classified WMD information to the press and to bolster the case for going to war. The White House made no direct response to Pillar's claims. Pillar said the White House had simply ignored intelligence that did not conform with his intention to invade. He said the broadly held intelligence assessment was that the best way to deal with the weapons problem was through an aggressive inspections program to supplement the sanctions already in place. Pillar said a CIA assessment of the implications of a U.S.-led occupation had presented a picture of a political culture that would not provide fertile ground for democracy and foretold a long, difficult, and turbulent transition, including guerrilla attacks and sectarian conflicts. This from The Guardian.
In Los Angeles, a fight between Hispanics and blacks at the Men's Central Jail has left another black inmate dead. The 38-year-old inmate is the second black prisoner to die in racially motivated brawls that have rocked the Los Angeles County jail system for over a week. Sheriff's deputies say the man was killed yesterday afternoon after he and another black inmate fought against four Hispanics in a six-person cell. Deputies broke up the fight with verbal commands and removed the injured black prisoner when he complained of pain. On the way to the jail's clinic, the inmate collapsed. Deputies say paramedics tried to revive him, but were unsuccessful and pronounced him dead at the scene. Officials weren't not yet releasing the man's name or more information on his injuries. The other black inmate was treated for minor injuries.
The first photograph of President George Bush with the disgraced Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff was published yesterday after the White House refused for weeks to release images of them together. Bush is seen meeting the chief of a Native American tribe that Mr. Abramoff hoped to represent. The lobbyist appears as a small, blurry, bearded figure in the background. Karl Rove, the chief White House political advisor, is also in the photograph. Abramoff has agreed to give evidence against top politicians whom he allegedly bribed. This may prove to be the biggest congressional scandal in U.S. history. Abramoff pleaded guilty to engaging in a conspiracy involving corruption of public officials, as well as fraud and tax evasion after striking a deal with federal prosecutors. The White House insisted that Bush could not recall having met Mr. Abramoff. It is saying that the president has his photograph taken with thousands of people every year. However, this would appear to jar with an email sent by Abramoff last week in which he boasted of his closeness to the president. Of the meeting shown in the photograph, Abramoff said, "I was standing right next to the window, and after the picture was taken, the president came over and shook hands with me, and we chatted and joked." The photograph was released to the media by Raul Garza, the chief of the 800-strong Kickapoo traditional tribe of Texas. Garza is currently under federal indictment for allegedly embezzling more than $300,000 from his tribe. This from The Guardian.
The response to Hurricane Katrina was a national failure and an abdication of the most solemn obligation to provide for the common welfare. This is according to details from the first of three anticipated reports into the disaster published yesterday. The report by a committee of Republicans in the House of Representatives declared that all the little pigs built houses of straw. The report is entitled A Failure of Initiative, and it's due to be published fully on Wednesday. Criticizes the Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, saying his detachment from events led him to implement federal emergency response measures late, ineffectively, or not at all. It finds that President George Bush was the one person who could have cut through the bureaucratic paralysis, crippling the federal response to last summer's hurricane. It adds that the White House did not substantiate, analyze, or act on the information at its disposal. It also questions why the untrained Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA chief Michael Brown, why was he selected to lead the response to the disaster, noting that he and the U.S. military set up rival chains of command. The details were leaked to the Washington Post as residents of New Orleans took the latest step back towards normality at the weekend. New Orleans kicked off the Mardi Gras season with a parade featuring effigies of the city's mayor, Ray Nagin, and the Louisiana governor, Kathleen Blanco, and floats with themes such as C'est la vie. The House Select Committee behind the 600-page report was boycotted by Democrats, who are calling for an independent commission to investigate the response to Hurricane Katrina. They argued that the committee's work was compromised because it did not compel the White House to hand over documents and had held no administration officials accountable. The committee, chaired by Republican Representative Thomas Davis, held 9 hearings and considered 500,000 pages of documents. Following the leak of a 60-page summary of the report, Democrats called for Mr. Chertoff's removal. Local officials, including the New Orleans mayor and Governor Blanco, were also criticized in the report for not completing the mandatory evacuation order issued on August 28th. This according to The Guardian.
The CIA's top counterterrorism official was fired last week because he opposed detaining al-Qaeda suspects in secret prisons abroad, sending them to other countries for interrogation, and using forms of torture such as waterboarding, according to The Times. Robert Grainer, head of the CIA Counterterrorism Center, was relieved of his post after a year in the job. One intelligence official said he was not quite as aggressive as he might have been in pursuing al-Qaeda leaders and networks. Vincent Canestraro, a former head of counterterrorism at the agency, said, "It's not that Grainer wasn't aggressive enough. It is that he wasn't with the program." He expressed misgivings about the secret prisons in Europe and the rendition of terrorists. Grainer also opposed excessive interrogations such as strapping suspects to boards and dunking them in water, according to Canestraro. Porter Goss was apparently angered by a series of leaks from CIA insiders, including revelations about black sites in Europe, where top al-Qaeda detainees were said to have been held. In last Friday's New York Times, Goss wrote that leakers within the CIA were damaging the agency's ability to fight terrorism and causing foreign intelligence organizations to lose confidence. Goss is believed to have blamed Grainer for allowing the leaks to occur on his watch. Since the appointment of Goss, the CIA has lost almost all of its high-level directors amid considerable turmoil. A.B. Buzzy Krongard, a former executive director of the CIA who resigned shortly after Goss's arrival, said the leaks were unlikely to stop soon, despite proposals to subject officers to more lie detector tests.
Strategists at the Pentagon are drawing up plans for devastating bombing raids, backed by submarine-launched ballistic missile attacks against Iran's nuclear sites. This would be as a last resort to block Tehran's efforts to develop an atomic bomb. According to the Telegraph, Central Command and Strategic Command planners are identifying targets, assessing weapons loads, and working on logistics for an operation. They're reporting to the office of Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, as America updates plans for action if the diplomatic offensive fails to thwart the Islamic Republic's nuclear bomb ambitions. Tehran claims that it is developing only a civilian energy program. The prospect of military action could put Washington at odds with Britain. Britain fears that an attack would spark violence across the Middle East. There's also concern that there would be reprisals in the West, and the attack still might not cripple Tehran's nuclear program. But the steady flow of disclosures about Iran's secret nuclear operations and the virulent anti-Israeli threats of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has prompted the fresh assessment of military options by Washington. The most likely strategy would involve aerial bombardments by long-distance B-2 bombers, each armed with up to 40,000 pounds of precision weapons, including the latest bunker-busting devices. Bunker-busting devices are nuclear weapons. They would fly from bases in Missouri with mid-air refueling. The Bush administration has recently announced plans to add conventional ballistic missiles to the armory of its nuclear Trident submarines within the next 2 years. If ready in time, they would also form part of the plan of the attack.
The United States is helping Morocco build a new interrogation and detention facility for Al-Qaeda suspects near its capital, Rabat, according to Western intelligence sources. The sources confirmed last week that the building was underway at Ain Alwida, south of Rabat's diplomatic district. Locals have said that they often seen American vehicles with diplomatic plates in the area. The construction of the new compound, run by the Direction de la Sécurité du Territoire, the Moroccan secret police, adds to a substantial body of evidence that Morocco is one of America's principal partners in the secret rendition program in which CIA flies prisoners to third countries for interrogation. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other groups critical of the policy have compiled dossiers detailing the detention and apparent torture of radical Islamists at the DST's current headquarters at Tamara, near Rabat. A recent inquiry into rendition by the Council of Europe, led by Dick Marty, the Swiss MP, highlighted a pattern of flights between Washington, Guantanamo Bay, and Rabat's military airport at Saleh. French intelligence and diplomatic sources said the most recent such flight was in the first week in December, when four suspects were seen being led, blindfolded and handcuffed, from a Boeing 737 at Saleh and transferred into a fleet of American vehicles. This, according to the Times.
Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary, promised to strengthen military ties with North Africa yesterday in a visit that highlighted the growing importance of the region in Washington's battle against radical Islamists. Rumsfeld told authorities in Algiers that he wanted to increase military and counterterrorism cooperation with them. Pentagon officials admitted that arms sales were a possibility. The Algerian army is still seen as a considerable power in the shadows after hijacking control of the country when Islamists threatened to win elections in 1992. A handful of groups loosely allied with Al-Qaeda still operate in Algeria. A senior official traveling with Rumsfeld said that the U.S. was considering selling military equipment to Algeria. He gave no details beyond saying these might be for counterterrorism, this according to The Guardian.
A lawyer for Saddam Hussein says the U.S. offered to let Hussein live in exile if he would use his influence to end the Iraqi insurgency. Saleh al-Armouri said that Saddam had told him the Americans had offered to treat him like Napoleon, whom the British imprisoned on St. Helena Island in the Atlantic Ocean in the 19th century, if he called on the resistance to end its activities. Armouri reported that the Americans had told Hussein that if he turned down the offer, there was an alternative. Armouri said the other offer was for him to be treated like Mussolini. A U.S. military spokesman in Baghdad, Lieutenant Colonel Barry Johnson, dismissed the lawyer's report. He said this appears to be some vain attempt by a lawyer to make it look as if Saddam still has some power or authority over people, which he doesn't.
In Baghdad today, a suicide bomber detonated an explosive belt in a line of Iraqis waiting to receive government payments. 8 people were killed. 11 other people were killed in attacks elsewhere in the country, including 5 members of a Shiite religious party, 4 police officers, including a colonel. Ousted leader Saddam Hussein and his 7 co-defendants appeared in court as their trial resumed, with the former president complaining that he had been forced to attend. The suicide attack occurred in a mostly Shiite eastern district of Baghdad as people lined up at a bank Monday morning to receive government checks to compensate for incomplete food rations. British military police said today that they had arrested one man in their investigation of a video that appeared to show British soldiers abusing prisoners in Iraq. The Ministry of Defense declined to identify the man who was arrested last night. Video images first reported by the News of the World, a Sunday newspaper, appeared to show soldiers dragging several young Iraqis into a compound and beating them with fists and batons. The newspaper said the video was filmed in southern Iraq by a corporal 2 years ago. It did not name the soldier or the unit involved.
Nepal's top Maoist rebel leader has said the only future he can envision for King Gyanendra is exile or trial. Prachandra made his remarks in a BBC interview to mark the 10th anniversary of the Maoist revolt. He said a trial of the king might take place in a people's court, leading to possible execution. However, elsewhere in the interview, Prachandra also said he could envision Nepal remaining a monarchy if the people wanted it. His rebels now control much of the countryside, but this is a conflict most observers believe neither side can win militarily. The Maoists are pressing for an elected assembly to write a new Nepalese constitution. Prachandra said he believes such an assembly would make Nepal into a republic, but he said his party would accept the people's verdict. Asked if that meant he would theoretically be able to accept a person's verdict of keeping the monarchy, he said, "Yes, theoretically, it is like that." But asked later what place the king might have in Nepal 5 years from now, Prachandra said, "I think he'll either be executed by the people's court or maybe exiled." He said the king, who took direct political power a year ago, had left no room for compromise. Nepal does not allow capital punishment, and Prachandra's comments will shock many Nepalese and probably cause discomfort to a group of opposition parties which recently signed a political agreement with the Maoists.
With oil exporters Venezuela and Mexico leading, Latin America and the Caribbean posted a $100 billion trade surplus with the United States in 2005. This is up 32% from the previous year. Latin America and the Caribbean accounted for 17.5% of all goods and services imported by the United States. It's up just slightly from 2004. But the region accounted for a significantly lower percentage of U.S. exports in 2005. Venezuela's trade surplus with the United States rose to $27 billion last year. Mexico's was $50 billion. Brazil's trade surplus, $9 billion. Argentina, a $472 million U.S. surplus. The United States' overall trade deficit was $725 billion in 2005. Trade gap with China jumped 25% to a record $200 billion U.S. dollars. This according to Mercopress, a leading Latin American press service. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Monday, February 13th. Chris Andre edited the news, KBOO volunteers edited the tape stories, and Jim Thompson's on the board right now. KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Blaine Palmer.
And I'm Becca Bartleson. Portland area weather today, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain in the morning, highs in the 50s. Tonight, mostly cloudy to the north, lows in the high 30s to low 40s.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us this evening at 5 p.m. for the KBOO Evening News.
Wondering what to do with all that news on your mind? Volunteer in the KBOO Morning Newsroom. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, to find out how you can get involved. Visit our website at www.kboo.fm.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. They'll welcome your calls on a variety of topics. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour with interviews, commentary, and analysis of current issues. At 10 on Health Watch, hear an interview with Dr. Naika Goldberg. She's the author of The Woman's Healthy Heart Programming, Life-Saving Strategies for Preventing and Healing Heart Disease. 10:30 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen discusses which vegetable seeds should be started indoors from January through March. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Stay tuned for all of that. Have a good morning.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Monday, January 16th. Looking for a way to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day? Join other volunteers in commemorating the day in a way that honors the spirit of MLK's life by strengthening communities and bridging barriers. Whether you live in Multnomah County or Washington County, there's a project in or near your neighborhood. Paint a resource center, garden at the Oregon Food Bank, build a new home with Habitat for Humanity, and more. For more info, call 503-413-7787 or visit www.handsonportland.org to learn about other volunteer opportunities. Sisters of the Road will host the 14th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebration, MLK Every Day, traveling the road of change through nonviolence. There will be a march which will gather at 2 p.m. at Sisters of the Road, located at 133 Northwest 6th Avenue, and will begin marching at 3 p.m. The march will end with a rally and celebration at 4 p.m. at St. Mary's Academy, located at 1615 Southwest 5th Avenue. There will be various speakers at St. Mary's, and for more info, call 503-222-5694, extension 17. Sunnyside Elementary School will host a hunger banquet and awareness auction to benefit Oxfam America in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This event is to educate the community about global poverty. Participants will have the opportunity to partake in a meal that simulates world hunger and power dynamics. Sunnyside Elementary School is located at 3421 Southeast 7. Doors for the auction will open at 4 p.m. and the hunger banquet will begin promptly at 5 p.m. There is a small donation, but all money raised will be donated directly to Oxfam America, an organization committed to creating lasting solutions to global poverty, hunger, and social injustice. The 21st Annual Tribute to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. program includes musical and dance performances and inspirational speeches celebrating King's life, work, and legacy. This event is at Jefferson High School, located at 5210 North Kirby Street in Portland, and will begin at 6 p.m. There's a suggested donation, or you can bring 3 cans of food. This event will also be broadcast on KBOO 90.7 and Channel 28. Thank you for listening to the KBOO Community Calendar. I hope everyone takes time to remember the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and have a wonderful day. You are listening to KBOO, Independent Community Radio in Hood River, Portland, and Corvallis.
Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 16th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 3rd through March 4th. This year's festival highlights include films from Angola opening and closing the festival, and an examination of the African legacy in Mexico through screening, symposium, and community conversation. Additionally, there will be a spotlight on AIN Africa, Women Filmmakers Week, and appearances by some of the directors at the film festival. For more information, visit AfricanFilmFestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.
Jump if you get belly to town. Drink if you get belly to take her. Enjoy yourself as you think you saw me. Enjoy yourself as you think you saw me.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
Saturday, February the 11th, the PCC African Film Festival will host a special symposium and community conversation on the African legacy in Mexico. The program will offer the community an opportunity to learn more about the history. At 10 a.m., the program will start off with a trilogy presented by Mexican film director Rafael Robayar Corona. The trilogy From Flora to Guajit and His Work in Progress, Incursion into the Hills. In the afternoon, the director and other experts in the fields will speak on the Afro-Mexican identity, followed by a community conversation with local activists and audience members. Both events will be held in the new Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Auditorium Room 104 at the Cascade Campus.